This is Melissa. Today is the 16th of March, 2024. And I hope you're doing well. I just wanted to have a little bit of a chat about some of the things that I learned in reading the recent section of Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope entitled The Buffer Fringe. I also have to say that since my laptop died 2 or 3 weeks ago, I have another really nice computer, but I have not been able to successfully configure my software for recording. So when I'm talking to someone else and recording, my end of the volume is very low, and I use all the same settings that I did before with the laptop, but it isn't working. So what I have going on right now is a lot of feedback, and it's kind of annoying, but hopefully it doesn't come through on the recording. So, first of all, just didn't get a satisfactory explanation in Carol Quigley's book about what he means when he says the buffer fringe. He introduces that term more or less on page 12 or very near the beginning of the book when he said the fringes of Asia have been occupied by a semicircle of old dying civilizations, Islamic, Hindu, Chinese, Japanese. And these have been under pressure from Western civilization coming in from the oceans and the Orthodox civilization pushing outward from the heart of the Eurasian landmass. So when he starts off the actual section on the buffer fringe in my copy, I'm on page, this is the fourth section, and it is page 109. So, again, here he talks about this fringe of dying, shattered cultures. He said, he elaborates a little bit on where those would be, and he said, outside this fringe, chiefly responsible for shattering its cultures, is Western civilization. Then he also includes peripheral areas, that's the Americas, Australia, New Zealand, and the fringes of Africa. So in the buffer fringe, he spends a little bit of time in Africa. And yeah, like I said, I wasn't really satisfied with the explanation. I found something on carolquigley.net. It's a lecture that he delivered on the 13th of November, 1957. It was delivered to the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, Washington, D.C. And the title of the lecture was Comparative National Cultures. In that, he lays out a little bit more of what the buffer fringe is. He said, I want to begin by pointing out that we have a world today consisting of three great parts. At the center is the Soviet bloc. Around that is the fringe of shattered cultures, which I call the buffer fringe, running from the Islamic countries in the West through Afghanistan, India, Burma, and the rest of them to Eastern Asia. I call that the buffer fringe. So there's that. And I'm going to put up this article because there's another place in that where he gets into Christianity, which is interesting. And I'm going to refer back to that in a minute. But in this section, the buffer fringe, he talks about things that were going on in England and ways of seeing the world. Also, I just want to mention before I read this section, it's pouring. Just when I decided it was time to turn the mic on, it just started pouring, and you will hear that. So that's rain, and it's nice because it keeps everything green, and maybe there'll be enough of it so that come July, August, and September, it won't be brown and miserable. So he talks about Little England, which was kind of a backlash against empire. People such as Gladstone and Sir William Harcourt, who were Little Englanders. That means that they were against a lot of the imperial and expansion programs that England had carried out for many, many generations, really. And then he talked about, so there were anti-imperialists and then moderate imperialists. So there's this whole section there on my page 129. He said, however expensive colonies might be to a government, they could be fantastically profitable to individuals and companies. And I think that that idea there, when you think about Western civilization and particularly the expansion of the British Empire, it's important to think of companies like East India Company and individuals who profited greatly. Because in many ways, that's really how the world has run forever. Who profits? Who benefits, eh? So the following page, see, he's talking about the reasons why people are for Little England or just staying focused on their own country or for expansion. And I'm actually going to read you this section because I've had a fair bit of thinking around this page and a half. The new imperialism after 1870 was quite different in tone from that which the Little Englanders had opposed earlier. The chief changes were that it was justified on grounds of moral duty and of social reform, and not, as earlier, on grounds of missionary activity and material advantage. The man most responsible for this change was John Ruskin. This is an interesting thing here, because what Quigley has just said is that moral duty and social reform came to supplant missionary activity and material advantage. And you would actually think of missionary activity as moral duty or social reform. But I think Alan has said before in talks that let's just take India, for example, and the rail lines that the British laid down there. And he said, always in advance of the military operations or the economic strategies that were going on, you had the missionaries who went out to civilize the natives, if you will, to bring them religion, which was a softening influence. So the man most responsible for this change was John Ruskin. Until 1870, there was no professorship of fine arts at Oxford, but in that year, thanks to the Slade bequest, John Ruskin was named to such a chair. He hit Oxford like an earthquake. Not so much because he talked about fine arts, but because he talked also about the empire and England's downtrodden masses, and above all, because he talked about all three of these things as moral issues. Until the end of the 19th century, the poverty-stricken masses in the cities of England lived in want, ignorance, and crime, very much as they have been described by Charles Dickens. Ruskin spoke to the Oxford undergraduates as members of the privileged ruling class. He told them that they were the possessors of a magnificent tradition of education, beauty, rule of law, freedom, decency, and self-discipline, but that this tradition could not be saved and did not deserve to be saved unless it could be extended to the lower classes in England itself and to the non-English masses throughout the world. If this precious tradition were not extended to these two great majorities, the minority of upper-class Englishmen would ultimately be submerged by these majorities and the tradition lost. To prevent this, the tradition must be extended to the masses and to the empire. Ruskin's message had a sensational impact. His inaugural lecture was copied out in longhand by one undergraduate, Cecil Rhodes, who kept it with him for 30 years. Rhodes, who lived from 1853 to 1902, feverishly exploited the diamond and gold fields of South Africa, rose to be prime minister of the Cape Colony, contributed money to political parties, controlled parliamentary seats both in England and South Africa, and sought to win a strip of British territory across Africa from the Cape of Good Hope to Egypt. And to join these two extremes together with a telegraph line and ultimately with a Cape to Cairo railway. Rhodes inspired devoted support for his goals from others in South Africa and in England. With financial support from Lord Rothschild and Alfred Beit, he was able to monopolize the diamond mines of South Africa as De Beers Consolidated Mines and to build up a great gold mining enterprise as Consolidated Goldfields. In the middle 1890s, Rhodes had a personal income of at least £1 million sterling a year, which was then about $5 million, which was spent so freely for his mysterious purposes that he was usually overdrawn on his account. These purposes centered on his desire to federate the English-speaking peoples and to bring all the habitable portions of the world under their control. For this purpose, Rhodes left part of his great fortune to found the Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford in order to spread the English ruling class tradition throughout the English-speaking world as Ruskin had wanted. Okay, let's repeat this. This is what the Rhodes Scholarships supposedly were for: to spread the English ruling class tradition throughout the English-speaking world as Ruskin had wanted. Among Ruskin's most devoted disciples at Oxford were a group of intimate friends, including Arnold Toynbee, Alfred, later Lord Milner, Arthur Glazebrook, George, later Sir George Parkin, Philip Littleton Gell, and Henry, later Sir Henry Burchinow. These were so moved by Ruskin that they devoted the rest of their lives to carrying out his ideas. A similar group of Cambridge men, including Reginald Balliol Brett, Lord Esher, Sir John B. Seeley, Albert Lord Grey, and Edmund Garrett, were also aroused by Ruskin's message and devoted their lives to extension of the British Empire and uplift of England's urban masses as two parts of one project, which they called Extension of the English-Speaking Idea. They were remarkably successful in these aims because England's most sensational journalist, William T. Stead, an ardent social reformer and imperialist, brought them into association with Rhodes. This association was formally established on February 5, 1891, when Rhodes and Stead organized a secret society of which Rhodes had been dreaming for 16 years. In this secret society, Rhodes was to be leader. Stead, Brett, Lord Esher, and Milner were to form an executive committee. Arthur Balfour, Harry Johnston, Lord Rothschild, Albert Grey, and others were listed as potential members of a circle of initiates, while there was to be an outer circle known as the Association of Helpers, later organized by Milner as the Round Table Organization. Brett was invited to join this organization the same day and Milner a couple of weeks later on his return from Egypt, both accepted with enthusiasm. Thus, the central part of the secret society was established by March 1891. It continued to function as a formal group, although the outer circle was apparently not organized until between 1909 and 1913. It goes on to talk about the funding of the different groups and so forth, and there may be a little bit more that I want to read. The following two pages talk in greater detail about how the round tables were organized, the round table publication itself, and then leading on into federations, what we might call now, all these years later, a world federalist organization. But the idea was empire expanding and federalization. So who is John Ruskin and why do I care? Well, I don't know, because I'm odd that way with what catches my attention, maybe. But I didn't give it that much thought until a couple of weeks ago on the Redux that I put up, which was a kind of a two-part Redux entitled Life Was the Lie and Farm for Sale. Alan Watt mentioned Elihu Yale, and what he said was front people, societies, and how we're given front people and persuaders. You understand, Alan said, you're persuaded to do everything and give up your rights and freedoms. So you do it by giving them fancy titles and little courses at university. And you call them ethics experts and bioethics experts as well. They then interpret what's good for the humans because they use scientific principles, you see. Of course, they're all funded and paid for by the big global corporations that run universities to decide what kind of culture they want to be taught to future leaders. That's what universities are really for today. They give a culture to train. That's not new. I mean Elihu Yale. I think it was Yale, and his, when he founded Yale University, said that really the purpose of it was to ensure the proper values would be taught to future leaders, etc. That's what it's always really been, you know. Of course, now you have the Skull and Bones as well, and Alan left, which is rather telling, with its own war room. When he mentioned Elihu Yale, who he had mentioned several times, and the founding of Yale University, and then in this talk said, that's what it's for, sending out future leaders, training them what they should think, and then how to share that or persuade us to think that too. And Alan had talked before, mentioned several times before, that Elihu Yale had worked for the East India Company. And I'd never really looked into him. So I just took a quick glance, and the years that Elihu Yale lived were from 1649 until 1721. He was a British-American colonial administrator and philanthropist. Although he was born in Boston, Massachusetts, he only lived in America as a child, spending the rest of his life in England, Wales, and India. So it talks about him becoming a clerk for the East India Company, and then eventually rising to the presidency of the settlement of Madras. Now, there's a couple of things I just want to say quickly about Elihu Yale, because this is not part of Quigley or Tragedy and Hope. The first thing is that he was removed from that post because of charges of corruption for self-dealing, and he had to pay a fine. He amassed a considerable fortune, mostly by selling diamonds, and he spent his time and wealth collecting art and doing philanthropy. Madras was known for the slave trade, and if you look around I say this because we live in a time, like, for instance, I mentioned last week that Lord Balfour's painting had been defaced. It had been painted and slashed and basically ruined because of the Balfour Declaration and what's going on with Palestine and Israel now. But Yale University is still called Yale University even though Elihu Yale benefited from slavery. Just a few interesting things there. East India Company is about trade. So we now go back, if you want to think about the idea of the British Empire and trade and John Dee, you know, we're just going back and back and back in time, because empire and acquisition are at the heart of the ancient brotherhood. But in this book of Quigley's, In Tragedy and Hope, he repeatedly says in the book and in other lectures that he gave that what really defines Western civilization is Christianity. And here again in this 1957 lecture that he delivered, Quigley said, "When I speak of Western ideology, I refer specifically to religion, Christianity, to such things as the scientific outlook, and to a third thing which I will call the liberal outlook. It may not be clear to you as I speak, because in all of this I am oversimplifying most drastically. I hope you will understand that. But it would seem to me that there is a common element to all three of these, the Christian outlook, the scientific outlook, and the liberal outlook. And to sum it up rather briefly, the outlook is this. All three believe that there is a truth somewhere. They all believe that it is worthwhile seeking that truth. They all believe that the process by which we seek that truth is a process in which we approach it in time. That is, truth is something which unfolds in time. Therefore, we must constantly work and strive and discuss in order to get closer and closer and closer to the truth, which we perhaps never reach. This is why scientists don't stop work today in the smug idea that they have the truth, but they have to go on struggling because of what they have today is simply an approximation of the truth." Another characteristic of all three of these is that the unfolding of truth in time results from a cooperative effort. That is, it's a social effort. It arises from discussion, criticism, and so forth. And from that emerges a kind of consensus, which is closer to the truth than would be the point of view of any single individual. So thus, we have that there is a truth. This is not a skeptical outlook. It is not a dogmatic outlook, because nobody now has the truth. It puts great emphasis on chronological development. It puts great emphasis upon social cooperation. Some of this may not seem convincing to you, and I imagine that the field in which it will not seem convincing is perhaps the field of religion. But the Christian religion basically does have this outlook. It believes that religious truth has been unfolded in time. That is, we had a whole series of revelations and prophets. We have the Old Testament, which was not replaced but supplemented by the New Testament. And the New Testament has been interpreted and unfolded in the course of time to reveal additional truth. And the process of religious appreciation still goes on. Am I right? Now, one other thing that I should emphasize about the Western ideology, and particularly the Christian ideology, is this. It is not a dualistic ideology. This is a point which many people, I think, misunderstand, because there has been a tendency, at least in the last 500 years, for the Christian or religious outlook to be dualistic. By that I mean that they oppose the material world to the spiritual world. That this was not fundamentally the point of view of the religious outlook of Western civilization for at least the first 1,000 years. During the first 1,000 years, they recognized the basic necessity of the material world. I could point this out in a number of ways. So he goes on, this is an article or a lecture worth reading, keeping in mind everything that all of us have already said, including Alan Watt, about Carol Quigley. But I don't want to get too far away from John Ruskin. Reading that in Tragedy and Hope, had given me pause for a moment because I realized that I had never heard Alan speak about John Ruskin, Rhodes, to be sure, and Milner and the Roundtable groups, but not John Ruskin. I made a note to myself, let's look into him when we can. But then I didn't get around to it. But then yesterday, I posted another one of the listener-made series called Signs and Symbols. And I had chosen, like a week ago, to put up one called Hidden Hand. And I meant to put it up a week ago, but it was just so crazy. I didn't have time to eat last week. And so I finally got around to putting it up yesterday. And by putting it up, part of putting it up means I made the little CTTM title card that goes in front of the video, and then I rendered it, and I watched it. Hidden Hand is that pose or gesture that Napoleon was so famous for, his hand tucked into his waistcoat or vest, as we call that in America. And it's a good little video, less than 10 minutes, that just shows all kinds of, mostly men, but a few women, down through time, with their hand in such a pose. So I went ahead and uploaded that video. And still Ruskin was on my mind, and the idea that, well, it's been 6 weeks almost, or 5 weeks, since we had any kind of discussion in book club, and maybe there's something that I have to say. So I looked up John Ruskin, and I had to laugh, because there on Wikipedia is young John Ruskin with his hand tucked into his jacket. I tell you what made me laugh. The more that I read about John Ruskin on Wikipedia, the more I wondered, how on earth was this man so influential to Cecil Rhodes? What was it? Because obviously I didn't have time in the course of a 24-hour period to actually read John Ruskin's writing, which was prolific. So here is the man. He lived from 1819 to 1900. He was an English writer, philosopher, art historian, art critic, and polymath of the Victorian era. He wrote on subjects as varied as geology, architecture, myth, ornithology, literature, education, botany, and political economy. Now, we don't want to forget that section that I just read to you. Among Ruskin's most devoted disciples at Oxford were a group that also included the historian Arnold Toynbee. And that is one name among a handful of names, and I don't know what roles other than their round table, their colonial governorships, or the different roles that they might have played in furthering the British Empire. But Toynbee gave a whole generation, as Quigley did in his own way, the correct view of history. So just something interesting to note there. This character, Ruskin, just fascinated me no end, because he spent the majority of his career criticizing art. How did this man end up influencing empire builders? So that is the rabbit hole that I've gone down in the past 24 hours, and I'm just going to share odd little things. And you can put it together in a way, if it means something to you, great, but odd little things. Here's the first odd little thing. He published a book called Modern Painters in 1843. And basically the premise of the book was that the artist needs to be true to nature, something that he called truth to nature. He championed the pre-Raphaelites who were influenced by his ideas. So artists who were pre-Raphaelites. So what is a pre-Raphaelite painter? I won't list all of the different painters, but here is what they call the pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, a group of English painters, poets, and art critics, founded in 1848. They formed a 7-member brotherhood, partly modeled on the Nazarene movement. Okay, what is the Nazarene movement? Is that like Jesus of Nazareth? Well, the Nazarene movement was adopted by a group of early 19th century German Romantic painters who aimed to revive spirituality in art. All right, so just these little bits, but let's go back to the pre-Raphaelites for just a moment. They wanted to properly represent nature in what they painted. They believed that art possessed a spiritual component that had been lost in the last several hundred years. They believed that the observation of nature that had been idealized rather than correctly presented had destroyed the spiritual element of art. The Brotherhood's early doctrines were expressed in 4 declarations: to have genuine ideas to express, to study nature attentively so as to know how to express them, to sympathize with what is direct and serious and heartfelt in previous art, and exclude that which is conventional and self-parading and learned by rote, and to produce thoroughly good pictures and statues. Well, it all sounds harmless enough, but so this is what Ruskin championed. Interesting. Who was Ruskin? Well, if you read his bio, he was just raised by a businessman father who was a wine importer and his wife who was described as an evangelical Christian. He was told by his mother that he needed to read the Bible start to finish and then read it again start to finish and memorize huge sections of it. His father wanted him to be a poet, in fact, even poet laureate. So they had big ambitions for their son. But we don't really know who he was because there's a lot that we don't know about people who are, we're told, so influential. But there he is with his hand in his jacket. What else struck me about this man? He was married one time to a woman named Effie Gray. And their marriage lasted about 6 years, and it was annulled. Who is Effie Gray? Why did the marriage last such a short amount of time? And why was the marriage annulled? Well, we learn that Effie Gray was considerably younger than he was. That in fact, one of the things that Ruskin did was write a fairy tale. And it is said that he even influenced people such as C.S. Lewis, who came later, in the fantasy and Christian fantasy writing. Why did he write his first piece of fantasy? It turns out that he wrote it to impress a 12-year-old girl who he was considerably older than, and he would go on to marry that 12-year-old girl, and that was Effie Gray. Their marriage was not consummated. That means they never had sex. And this has been debated. Why was this? Effie Gray said that it was because he was repulsed by aspects of her. She ended up leaving him, having the marriage annulled, and then marrying a painter, John Everett Millais, who had been championed as a Pre-Raphaelite painter by Ruskin. She wrote that there was some apparent disgust that Ruskin had with part of her body. Ruskin later confirmed this to his attorney, to his lawyer during the annulment proceedings. He wrote, "It may be thought strange that I could abstain from a woman who to most people was so attractive. But though her face was beautiful, her person was not formed to excite passion. On the contrary, there were certain circumstances in her person which completely checked it," meaning quashed it or squashed it or ruined it for him. So the reason for Ruskin's disgust with, quote, circumstances in her person, end quote, is unknown. Various suggestions have been made, including that it was revulsion with her pubic hair or her menstrual blood. We don't know. What Effie said was that he persistently put off consummating the marriage. They had initially agreed that they would not have sex so that he could concentrate on his studies. But when this dragged on and on and on, she said in a letter that she wrote to her father, he alleged various reasons, hatred to children, religious motives, a desire to preserve my beauty, and finally, this last year, he told me his true reason, that he had imagined women were quite different to what he saw I was, and that the reason he did not make me his wife was because he was disgusted with my person the first evening. So he took a look at her without her clothes on and was like, okay, if this is what women are, I'm not into it. So that's John Ruskin. And he never did marry again, although here's a little interesting thing about Ruskin in his middle life. He later took on the education of a young girl by the name of Rose Latouche. Ruskin had been introduced to the wealthy Irish Latouche family by Louisa, Marchioness of Waterford. Maria Latouche, a minor Irish poet and novelist, asked Ruskin to teach her daughters drawing and painting in 1858. Rose Latouche was 10. His first meeting came at a time when Ruskin's own religious faith was under strain. This always caused difficulties for the staunchly Protestant Latouche family, who at various times prevented the two from meeting. A chance meeting at the Royal Academy in 1869 was one of the few occasions they came into personal contact. After a long illness, she died at the age of 27. These events plunged Ruskin into despair and led increasingly to severe bouts of mental illness involving breakdowns and delirious visions. Ruskin turned to spiritualism. He attended seances at Broadlands. Ruskin's increasing need to believe in a meaningful universe and life after death, both for himself and his loved ones, helped to revive his Christian faith in the 1870s. Now, in something else that I read about this little obsession that he had with Rose Latouche when she was 10, is that he wanted to marry her, and she seemed to say that that might be okay, but she didn't want to consummate the union, and he did not agree. He said, "I've already been publicly embarrassed by having one unconsummated union. I'm not going to do this a second time." But he continued to pursue her, and I believe that her parents just asked her outright, what do you think of this man? And she described him as overbearing. And so that's basically when they put an end to that going anywhere. Then much later in his life, he developed a friendship with a woman whose name is not in front of me right now, but she was an illustrator of books for children. And in their correspondences, he told her that it would be good for her as an illustrator, and he would enjoy, and I'll just, you know, I mean, the way that he wrote it was in this quaint language of more than a century ago, but he was essentially asking this illustrator to draw him pictures of naked little girls. So this is just another glimpse into John Ruskin. But why, oh why, did he have such an impact on Cecil Rhodes, who just, by the by, never married and has been widely thought of as being homosexual? Up for debate, but there you go. So Ruskin, in his later years, as he moved away from art, and he moved into social critique, began to write against capitalism and for ideas that have been championed by Christian socialists. Many labor leaders in the UK have described him as being much more influential on their thinking than Marx, for instance. So he did have a big impact. Here is a little section on his social critique. At a certain point in his life, he said, "I gave up my artwork and wrote Unto This Last." That was the title of an essay that was critical of economics. Unto This Last. "This became the central work of my life. Following his crisis of faith and urged to political and economic work by his professed master, Thomas Carlyle, Ruskin shifted his emphasis from art towards social issues." And this is when he went on to deliver lectures such as what Rhodes would have heard, that English people must deliver a way of life to the rest of the world, and concentrated on attacking industrial capitalism and the utilitarian theories of political economy. His social view broadened, and right now I'm just reading straight out of Wikipedia, from concerns about the dignity of labor to consider issues of citizenship and notions of the ideal community. Just as he had questioned aesthetic orthodoxy in his earliest writings, he now dissected the orthodox political economy espoused by John Stuart Mill, based on theories of laissez-faire, and criticized the work of Adam Smith, etc. He rejected the division of labor as being dehumanizing, and argued that the false science of political economy failed to consider the social affections that bind communities together. So it was his writing about what men owed society that would ultimately catapult him into a kind of fame that has even outlived him. It is said that his current influence now reaches to things like sustainability and environmentalism. So here is another little article about Ruskin. It was during this time that he had turned his attention to social and political issues that he began teaching at the Working Men's College set up by the Christian socialists Frederick James Furnival and Frederick Denison Maurice. Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, was said to have been incredibly moved upon reading Ruskin's work and went about establishing the Phoenix community, which was based on the values that Ruskin had promoted. At the settlement, everyone was to receive the same wages without any marked distinction between the type of work undertaken or the race or creed of the participants, which for South Africa was quite revolutionary. Ruskin was in no doubt about the importance of his work. He said, "I gave up my artwork and wrote unto this last to become the central work of my life." When his father, the wealthy businessman, died, he left his son a fortune. And Ruskin vowed to use that fortune to ameliorate the suffering of the poorest sectors of society. And he began a kind of something he called the Guild of St. George, give training and education to the poorer people that lived there. At the heart of the Guild's philosophy was the renunciation of modern capitalism and industrialization, which was seen to enslave and restrict the growth of the laboring poor. This was to be replaced at St. George's by what was seen as a more benign, ethically driven culture that promoted the activities of medieval crafts and the material and spiritual betterment of the participants. Ruskin wanted to expose the profit motive behind industrial expansion and inspire people to reject Adam Smith's notion of the division of labor and its resulting use of mass production techniques. Ruskin was not only concerned about the alienating effect this process had on individuals, but society at large. He also objected to the increasing spread of urbanization into the country and the resulting pollution it brought in its wake. It's interesting, I think, don't you, that Cecil Rhodes copied out these lectures that Ruskin delivered and carried them with him for his life. And it's interesting, it's almost as if the Round Table movement somehow, from somewhere, got marching orders that expansion that is seen as just the acquisition of resources and the increasing of an empire in this era cannot be supported, but expansion that purports to deliver a better way of life is something that people can get behind ideologically. So again, it takes me back to what Alan was saying about Elihu Yale, which is, what do universities teach? They teach proper values to be taught to future leaders. Just positing here that maybe the pool of purely psychopathic people to be drawn from wasn't big enough. So the proper values have to be taught to them. They have to believe they're doing something beautiful. They're creating utopia. And what is also interesting to me here is Carol Quigley's assertion that it is Christianity itself which is Western civilization, but Christianity and the history of Christianity, it's a lot of things to a lot of different people. For instance, Ruskin was raised by an evangelical mother. Elihu Yale didn't really seem to have any religion, but he was happy to lend his name to Yale University. Why did he do that? Because the Reverend Cotton Mather, a Puritan, was a Harvard graduate, and he wanted to head Harvard, but that had been shot down. And so as a way of getting back at Harvard, he stirs the pot there and creates a competing establishment. he championed Yale College as being the intellectual bulwark or the support of Puritanism in New England. And he was a promoter of the new experimental science or the scientific revolution. So it's also, just out of interest, Cotton Mather himself researched into a type of inoculation. So what did Quigley say we had going on with Western civilization? Christianity, the scientific outlook, and the liberal outlook. But there's so much at play there. What does it mean to so many different people who participate in this system? When I was thinking about somebody like Ruskin, who is described in places as a philosopher, an art historian, art critic, philosopher, I started thinking about philosophers down through time and how their writing can cause or contribute to revolution and revolutionary ideas. And I thought about Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was, you know, 100 years earlier than Ruskin, who is a philosopher who was so instrumental in the Age of Enlightenment era and all of those enlightened ideas. And he wrote A Discourse on Inequality, which argued that private property is the source of inequality. And he wrote something called The Social Contract, which outlined the basis for a legitimate political order. These are the cornerstones in modern political and social thought. And it is said that his writing contributed strongly to the ideas that infused the French Revolution. Some people say that he didn't have, that his writing didn't have such a big impact on the American Revolution, but other writers disagree and say absolutely it did. Will Durant, so if we're talking about Toynbee and Quigley, Will and Ariel Durant said that Rousseau had a definite political influence on America. According to them, the first sign of Rousseau's political influence was in the wave of public sympathy that supported active French aid to the American Revolution. Jefferson derived the Declaration of Independence from Rousseau as well as from Locke and Montesquieu. And as ambassador to France, he absorbed much from both Voltaire and Rousseau. The success of the American Revolution raised the prestige of Rousseau's philosophy. One other little thread in my mind was art and how philosophy, thinking, what contribute to art. And I say art as a shaper of men's minds. Because remember what Alan always talked about, Plato, and how these things needed to be licensed. So if you think about Ruskin and the Pre-Raphaelites, they have an idealized idea of the female. They have an idealized idea of nature, though they said they wanted to accurately portray nature. It's an idealization of nature. And it is also elevating nature to perhaps a higher level than, in other words, helping to knock man off of his pedestal. That man is not necessarily the highest creation, but just simply part of nature. Rousseau, there's some discussion whether or not he started the idea of the noble savage, but He said that the stage of human development associated with what he called savages was the best or optimal in human development. Between the less than optimal extreme of brute animals on the one hand and the extreme of decadent civilization on the other, nothing is so gentle as man in his primitive state when placed by nature at an equal distance from the stupidity of brutes and the fatal enlightenment of civil man. Artist that might have been affected by that thinking? Paul Gauguin, all those topless Tahitian ladies, and Gauguin's quite a handful of relationships with 12, 13, and 14-year-old girls when he was painting them. Rousseau doesn't get married, seems to have a weird relationship with a woman, and then, you know, who knows what he's up to. And just as a total aside, when we're talking about socialism and utopia, my total aside is the Fabian Society and George Bernard Shaw. Shaw has been called the second most important English playwright after William Shakespeare. And we'll hear Alan Watt talk about George Bernard Shaw in the Fabian Society and saying, and his, you know, people will have to come to us, you know, some panel of eugenicists to explain to us why they are necessary. In this aside, the Fabian Society was founded in 1884. They wanted to transform society by setting an example of clean, simplified living for others to follow. Some members also wanted to become politically involved to aid society's transformation, and they set up a separate society, the Fabian Society. All members were free to attend both societies. The Fabian Society additionally advocated renewal of Western European Renaissance ideas and their promulgation throughout the world. George Bernard Shaw found a pamphlet for the Fabian Society, and he immediately became involved in that and championed it. And he was the one who brought the Webbs, Beatrice and Sidney Webb, into the Fabian Society. And all through his writing, what is this? This is art. This is a play. He's promoting the ideas of the Fabians. Who was another Fabian? Havelock Ellis. Havelock Ellis was called a progressive intellectual and social reformer who studied human sexuality. He co-wrote the first medical textbook in English on homosexuality in 1897. So Havelock Ellis was the first and most influential in taking the stigma out of homosexuality, the disease and sin component, and simply saying that it was natural. He also wrote on what we now call transgender psychology. So he may well have been the first writer to write about transgender psychology. And he also was a pioneering investigator of psychedelic drugs. So that's Havelock Ellis. What do we know about Havelock Ellis? He was married to an openly lesbian woman. It says from the beginning, their marriage was unconventional. She was openly lesbian. And at the end of the honeymoon, Ellis went back to his bachelor rooms. She had several affairs with women, and her husband was aware of that. It said the marriage was strange one by both Victorian and modern standards. The couple did not engage in sexual relations with each other, and Ellis himself admitted, "I was conscious of no inevitably passionate sexual attraction to her." Partly because of his relationship with his lesbian wife, he was inclined to write a textbook on homosexuality, and he compiled case histories on several dozen homosexuals to discuss their behaviors and make it clear that homosexuality was a natural phenomenon as opposed to a disease or a sin. I don't know. We don't know much about Havelock Ellis, except he was married to a lesbian and appeared to not have any other relationships of a sexual nature, except hearing other people talk about their experiences and writing about it and normalizing things which up until then had not been normal. And George Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw was married to a woman named Charlotte Payne Townshend, or Townsend, however you'd say that. It's got the SH in there. Okay, so they married when he was nearly 42. She was 6 months younger. They appeared to have had a happy marriage of being good friends and in a way inseparable. This is what it says. Their marriage is generally believed never to have been consummated. Whether this was wholly at Charlotte's wish, as Shaw liked to suggest, is less widely credited. But they were good friends. So it would appear that George Bernard Shaw had a non-sexual relationship with his wife, and he wrote Man and Superman. This has been cited as being an important work. The Ubermann comes from Nietzsche's ideas about the Übermensch. Both the play and in the handbook, Shaw takes Nietzsche's theme that mankind is evolving through natural selection towards Superman and develops the argument to suggest that the prime mover in selection is the woman. So that's Man and Superman. Pygmalion, of course, becomes My Fair Lady. Shaw's expressed views were often contentious. He promoted eugenics, and that is what we know him for via Alan Watt, is the eugenics promotion. Before I ramble on too long, I think what most struck me about just going down that little bit of a rabbit hole on John Ruskin is that groups of people who shape policy and build empires and go around the world and meddle in other people's affairs are very often getting their ideas from a bent class of people and the bent class of artists and playwrights and writers and poets who promote these ideas. We often talk about and hear Alan talk about Hollywood and culture creators, but we have to remember this goes back to Plato, and culture creators and art have been around for an awful, awful long time. In Alan's Cutting Through Volume 1, he writes on page 12, "The priesthoods across the known world were international. They gave differing names for the same trinity. In this way, tribes or nations could be kept separated, each fearing and warring with the next. The priests gave them different languages, further confusing them, ensuring dialogue between peoples did not occur. It would have been disastrous for the controllers if the various people were to discuss their, quote, various, end quote, cultures, only to discover that they were the same. The top priests were named after the female deity. They, in every country, wore women's clothing. In Egypt, they were the priests of Isis. This, however, is the Greek rendition. The Egyptian term was Iris. they recruited from the brighter boys of the aristocracy. Interesting there, too. They recruited from, and Alan puts it in quotes, the brighter boys of the aristocracy. And that'll take me back to John Dee, who is credited for coming up with the term British Empire, which he called Brightish Empire. So this priesthood is recruited from the brighter boys of the aristocracy. Today, we use scholarships. Where do those scholarships come from? Well, places like Yale or Oxford that are chaired by people like Ruskin. And down through time, this is what you have. So Alan writes, today we use scholarships. As the sun's arc is measured in degrees, the managers, the sons of today, earn degrees. The ceremony, Ceres, another term for the goddess Isis, and Mon, man, requires the wearing of a woman's gown. Students are called pupils. That was my little aside. I think I've pretty well said it because, like I said, I've spent, 24 hours or the last day or so looking at Ruskin. What is the background? And that just led me to thinking about art and utopia and religion. And I think one other thing that I will say about religion, John Dee considered himself a Christian. He was a mathematician, astronomer, astrologer, occultist, alchemist, and so forth. But he did consider himself to be a Christian. Said Dee was an intense Christian, but his religiosity was influenced by Hermetic and Platonic Pythagorean doctrines, which were pervasive in the Renaissance. And that was that numbers were the basis of all things and the key to knowledge. From Hermeticism, he drew a belief that man had the potential for divine power that could be exercised through mathematics. His goal was to help bring forth a unified world religion through the healing of the breach of the Roman Catholic and Protestant churches and the recapture of the pure theology of the ancients. And that's one thing that I forgot to mention when I was talking about Rousseau, is that Rousseau was raised in Geneva, Switzerland, and at that time, that meant that he was a Calvinist. Geneva had been a Huguenot, or Huguenot as the French say, religious group of French Protestants. They were Calvinist in the Calvinist tradition of Protestantism. And to live in Geneva at that time meant that you had to be a Calvinist. And at a certain time, he made a move in his career and geographically, which required him to convert to Catholicism. But he eventually returned to being a Calvinist. So it said, after his stay in Paris, he returned to Geneva in 1754 and reconverted to Calvinism in order to regain his official Genevan citizenship. So all throughout what Quigley calls Western civilization as being Christian civilization, you quite rightly have some form of Christianity underpinning all of the movement, but it's different forms jockeying for supremacy or position. And right now, if you get into the alternate, I don't want to say conspiracy, but if you get into looking at history from a slightly outsider perspective, you're always going to get, the Jesuits are behind it, the Jesuits this and the Jesuits that. And many parts, thanks to Henry VIII and the execution of Thomas More, who, by the way, invented the term utopia, who lost his head was executed because he refused to acknowledge that Henry VIII was the head of the Church of England. You have got factions of religion at war with one another. One of the things that we talked about in reading Tragedy and Hope was that we want to have a fuller understanding of why we are where we are now. And I think, you know, just a crudest summation of where we are now is that man has been knocked off of his pedestal. Science is supreme. God has more or less lost centrality, and I'm sure that's gone on since the Age of Enlightenment. And you just have what you might call the buffer fringe, decaying society on the fringes of the new civilization, which has yet to reveal itself. So I think we're all behind on reading. I just wanted to ramble on about what caught my eye there. I haven't even finished The Buffer Fringe, and we're halfway through March. And where we should be in our reading is that we should be reading the next section, which is entitled The First World War and the Versailles System. I think those two sections there would take us, that is section 5, The First World War, 1914 to 1918, and the Versailles System and the Return to Normalcy, which is 1919 to 1929. But I haven't quite finished reading The Buffer Fringe, and I know that Adam and David will weigh in with a talk, and I think that probably a project that we hoped would take us to the end of the year, I think will probably take us just into 2025. But I think it's worth exploring this book. And for me, just to be able to go down that rabbit hole of Ruskin, to see that in addition to Christianity, the drivers of the scientific method, if you will, the drivers of empire and the drivers of the different organized religions do seem to be selected and groomed and promoted from a certain kind of aristocracy. And what interests me always is the deviancy that you find when you just scratch the surface. Someone so influential as John Ruskin in setting agendas, what I didn't even get into were all of the kind of utopian Ruskin kinds of schools that came out and that are actually still on the go today. His writings about nature and aesthetics still having an effect in the world around us today. And just so one last quick little thing here, I'll give you what is said to be his legacy. Ruskin's influence reached across the world. Tolstoy described him as one of the most remarkable men, not only of England and our generation, but of all countries and times. He quoted extensively from him and rendered his ideas into Russian. Gandhi wrote of the magic spell that was cast on him by reading Unto This Last. A number of utopian socialist Ruskin colonies attempted to put his political ideals into practice. These communities included Ruskin Florida, Ruskin British Columbia, and Ruskin Commonwealth Association. Ralph Radcliffe Whitehead was the founder of Birdcliff Colony in Woodstock, New York. This was partly inspired by his teacher Ruskin's beliefs. His work has been translated into numerous languages. Theorists and practitioners in a broad range of disciplines acknowledge their debt to Ruskin. Architects, including Louis Sullivan, Frank Lloyd Wright, Walter Gropius, incorporated his ideas in their work. writers as diverse as Oscar Wilde, G.K. Chesterton, T.S. Eliot, W.B. Yeats, and Ezra Pound felt Ruskin's influence. In the craft, in the world of craft, craftsmen, William Morris, it says, and C.R. Ashby were keen disciples, and through them, Ruskin's legacy can be traced in the arts and crafts movement, and that will bring you back as well to Frank Lloyd Wright. Pioneers of town planning say that they owe a legacy to Ruskin. Ruskin was an inspiration for many Christian socialists, and his ideas informed the work of economists such as William Smart and J.A. Hobson. Ruskin was discussed in university extension classes and reading circles, and societies formed in his name. Resident workers at Toynbee Hall, future civil servants Hubert Llewellyn Smith and William Beveridge, the future Prime Minister Clement Attlee, all acknowledged their debt to Ruskin as they helped found the British welfare state. That's another important idea, is that the idea that Ruskin had, or series of ideas, was the formation of the British welfare state. More of the British Labour Party's earliest MPs acknowledged Ruskin's influence than mentioned Karl Marx or the Bible. In Nazi Germany, Ruskin was seen as an early British National Socialist. William Montgomery McGovern's From Luther to Hitler identified Ruskin as a thinker who made Nazism possible. And one 1930s German headmaster told his students that Carlyle and Ruskin were the first National Socialists. And then it goes on to talk about the different streets, buildings, organizations, and institutions that bear his name, and the experimental schools and communities that still bear the influence and name of Ruskin. This is his legacy. I look at a man who liked naked drawings of little girls and didn't consummate his marriage with his wife. And I wonder how he went from that to someone so instrumental in shaping 1,000 different versions of utopia. But I don't believe in utopia. Utopia is always fantasy. There's no basis in reality. We can't point to anything except the most short-lived experiments to say that it might work or it has worked. It doesn't work. And I'd say one last thing, comparing the thinking of Alan Watt to Carol Quigley. And I would say, when Carol Quigley said that truth, what we have today, is an approximation of the truth, because truth is something that unfolds in time as a result from a cooperative effort. And it's a social effort that arises from discussion, criticism, and so forth. And from that emerges a kind of consensus, which is closer to the truth than would be the point of view of any single individual. So thus, we have that there is a truth. I would simply say, Alan said to me, truth is. And I do believe that there's something that is fairly close to that in the Cutting Through volumes. Truth is. It doesn't unfold or evolve down through time. It is. And it doesn't care whether you agree with it or not, or whether you wish to modify it or not. It just is. And in that way, truth is quite possibly what we hear nature is. You know, nature doesn't care. Nature is, you know, nature is harsh. Nature doesn't care whether you think it's all warm and fuzzy, you know, because if you're in the water and the shark is there, there goes you. That's nature. But that was Alan's assessment of truth. It is, and it is eternal, and it does not need discussion. It does not need consensus. This is what Alan writes about truth on page 7 of the Cutting Through volumes. To find truth obviously entails smashing the illusions we've come to love and hate at the same time. The addict wishes escapism. The hero in, the heroine, will destroy him. Yet the initial rush pushes all care to the rear, and for a short lapse of time, he blesses his killer, the illusion, that is. To search for the Creator, we must put all given religions to the side, as the addict must his syringe. We must bear the pain of withdrawal. Skipping down just a few sentences, Alan writes, truth is eternal and cannot be compromised. So there you go. For Carol Quigley, truth is something that evolves and needs to be cooperatively looked at. And Alan said truth is eternal and cannot be compromised. I wish you all a great week that we're headed into. I am looking forward to hearing what Adam and David have to say, which I know will be much more comprehensive and broad than my putting Ruskin under the microscope. And take care.